Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Well, here we are again at the Leading LDS podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum, and one thing you may not know about me is I'm recording this the week of Roots Tech in 2017, and I have the opportunity to draw caricatures at Roots Tech. It's going to be a lot of fun. But I digress, and this episode is another How I Lead episode where we talk with the most prolific leaders across the globe, whether they believe it or not, and we just ask them the simple question of, how is it that you lead? How do you go about your day-to-day, week-to-week responsibilities? And today, we're focusing on Elders Quorum. And I talked with Toby Eborn, who is a Elders Quorum president in Salt Lake City, Utah. And we go through various leadership principles that he's found most effective. And he has found a lot of success in just uniting the quorum and increasing home teaching numbers. And so we dive into that. So sit back, relax, and here is my interview with Toby Eborn. Today, I found myself in downtown Salt Lake City at the headquarters of Fire Toss and with Toby Eborn.
Hey,
right?
Hello. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, for sure. Now, what is it you do here at Fire Toss?
So I do sales.
A sales guy.
Yeah. I get to sit down with our clients before they come on board and help figure out what we can actually do to help them. We're a web design and digital marketing agency, so a lot of times it's some market research, trying to figure out what opportunities we have to help them grow their businesses online and mapping out the strategy and then getting them to sign on the dotted line, and then we get going.
Nice. And I don't know if you can mention any specific clients, but what's like some fun clients you've worked with, or your favorite type of clients you've brought on board?
So we work a lot in the trucking industry. It's a really strange market for a tech company to be in, but we work with the Utah Trucking Association pretty closely, and I work with them a lot. We have trucking clients all across the country, so we get to travel quite a bit and go to trade shows and conferences and meet with those people. So they're just good down-to-earth guys. Yeah. You know, we kind of joke that it's the good old boys network. They'd prefer to do business on a handshake. They're a lot of fun to work with.
So and these are smaller trucking companies? Or
some of them are. The one real prominent one we work with here in Utah is Andrus. And they're based in St. George, but they've got a good 350 trucks on the road. And so they're up and down I-15 all the time. But, they're not small operations. Even the ones that have 30 or 40 trucks, they're $20-30 million a year businesses.
Nice. So but nonetheless, that your company here, I mean, we're in a conference room where your logo is like fire burned on the wall here. Yeah. And there's ping pong tables or foosballs, our old school arcade games. Yeah. So this is like the millennial dream place to work.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely have a pretty fun environment here with guys that spend their day with their faces buried in a computer. They've got to have a way to stand up and break the monotony.
Yeah.
There's ping pong and pool table and a couple of arcade games. And the CEO of the company and I actually built this one night. We started
at
six. Yeah, we started at 6 in the evening. We burnt all the wood ourselves. We jigsawed out the logo. The people next door to us were not super happy. It took till about 2 o'clock in the morning for us to finish it.
So did you have like a torch in here doing this literally on the wall? Well, or
we set it up on sawhorses out in the parking lot.
Oh, out in the parking lot. Okay.
Yeah,
so we burned it there. So
we burned it outside and then scraped it down and clear coated it and then brought it in and cut it and put it up on the wall.
But looks nice.
It looks pretty cool.
That's cool. I guess I need to snap a picture so people have reference before I leave.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's great. Well, as I do in these How I Lead interviews, we got to put you into context, got to know your background. So I'm going to throw some rapid fire questions at you, but that doesn't mean your answer has to be rapid.
Okay.
So where were you raised?
I grew up in Bear Lake. I'm a Montpelier, Idaho kid.
Oh, nice.
Small town, like under 3,000 people. Went to a small high school, but my family's all from up there.
Is there, how many high schools are there?
Just one.
Just one?
Yeah. Well, there's one on the Utah side.
Oh, is there?
But on the Idaho side, there's just one high school.
Oh, great. And, let's see, where did you get baptized, or when did you get baptized?
I was baptized when I was 8, so what is that, 1989?
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, pretty traditional pioneer background.
Yep, pretty traditional background. My mom and dad both raised in the church. Their families both raised in the church. My parents met in middle school. They dated all through high school. My dad went on his mission, came home. They got married.
And right there in Montpelier, they were raised as well?
Oh, yeah, okay. They're both raised right there. Well, my dad was in Paris, 8 miles down the road.
Oh, okay.
Still in the valley.
Paris, Idaho.
Yeah, right. Paris, Idaho.
A beautiful place, for sure.
Yeah.
So how would you describe the development of your testimony through your youth?
So if I'm being super honest, I think my testimony probably didn't really develop until I was closer to being on a mission. Mm-hmm. You know, a small town, 2,700 people, 2 stakes, 11 wards, everybody was pretty much LDS. And so I didn't have a lot of exposure to things outside of LDS culture until I graduated high school and moved to Richmond, Virginia, which is a totally different world out there.
Oh, wow.
And so it was really, I leaned on the people that I grew up with, but I didn't really have a lot of variance in from the gospel at that age because there wasn't a lot of other options.
Yeah. And there's no reason to consider anything else.
Yeah, I had no reason to consider that there could have been something else out there. There's a tiny little Catholic church in my hometown that now is like a little branch building for the church.
The church owns it now.
Yeah, the church owns it now. So it's just, there just weren't many other options. So
interesting. So when you say you moved to Virginia, was that for your mission?
No. I graduated high school and I had a sister that was in the military. And so I went out and lived with her.
Oh, wow.
And so I went from a tiny town in LDS, Idaho, to big city, Richmond, Virginia, where members of the church were few and far between.
Yeah.
And it was a very, it was a culture shock for me for sure.
So would you say your belief structure was tested that time or you just reinforced?
Probably reinforced. I definitely had some like eye-opening experiences there as far as exposure to other religions and things like that, but it more reinforced what the way I was raised. I had opportunity with friends who were like, hey, let's go to the clubs. And I'd never been to the club before. So I went.
The club scene. The club scene.
Yeah. There's just not much there. And so I was with friends and they drank. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing them what I thought they just made fools out of themselves. And I'm like, man, I'm glad I never did that. And I have no desire to do that because I remember a guy that I worked with named Todd, who was a few years older than me, but we were there at these clubs and he couldn't even remember what happened the next day. But I remember the fact that when he paid out his tab at the club, it was like $120. And then the next day he's like, man, I don't remember anything. I was
pretty expensive. That's a loss of memory.
Yeah. It's a pretty expensive way to not remember what you do. And so it just, to me, it reinforced that I don't ever want to do that because I like remembering the experiences I have and I like keeping my money for other things. So
nice. Yeah. So you did end up on a mission then?
I did. Yeah. I ended up on a mission. I went to Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And had a fantastic experience. Spent a lot of time in the cold, a lot of time in the heat, but it was a great life-changing experience for me.
And how would you say that built onto your testimony the most? I mean, it obviously did, but in what way?
You know, I got put into some kind of difficult situations as a missionary. I got to be known as somebody who worked really hard and was pretty, what's the best way to say? I was very realistic with the people I worked with, but I worked hard and I was very genuine with people. So I got sent into situations where maybe some other missionaries made some mistakes and some of the other missionaries started calling me the trash man because I had to go and clean up people's messes. But I had a couple times where I went into a situation where a couple other missionaries got moved out at the same time because they weren't behaving the way they were supposed to. And so it kind of became up to me to help rebuild the relationship and some trust with the members of the area that I was serving in, but it was great.
But I imagine now that you work in sales, being genuine and hardworking is sort of helped paid off, in your secular life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably, in fact, my clients would probably attest to the fact that one of the reasons they went with me maybe wasn't because they believed that our company was as adept to doing things as we actually are, but they trusted me and they felt like I wasn't making a recommendation to them that I didn't honestly believe was the right thing to do. Cause I really try to make honest recommendations for people in whatever aspect. I'm not going to sugarcoat something with somebody. I'm also not going to try to push them into something that is not going to be good for them. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And then came home and did you go to college?
I did for a little bit. I went to Utah State for a little while. Uh-huh. I bounced all over the place. I was
wasn't sure what you're going to do.
Yeah, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. I worked in the restaurant industry, and I went to like a little culinary school type program. And so I worked in restaurants a lot, which is not the most stable place to make a career out of. But I bounced around a lot with that. I also got engaged really quickly after I got home from my mission, and then it blew up in my face.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I moved away from Utah State and that area because I was so sick of everybody being like, oh, where's your fiance? I thought you were going to be married by now. And I was so sick of explaining to people that it fell apart. Yeah. Yeah. And
so, was this a girl that waited for you on your mission?
Or? No, she didn't wait for me. It was a gal I met during my mission.
Oh, okay.
And she made good with my parents while I was still a missionary.
I see.
I had a very distant relationship with her while I was a missionary, but she was behind the scenes working things with my parents. And I got home, and 3 days later, they flew her out, and it was, yeah. So
things moved faster and a little bit out of control. Huh?
Yeah. Well, and when you're a brand new return missionary, like the world is.
Right.
And so it took me a little while to register that, okay, this is moving a little bit faster than I want. And then she didn't end up being quite the person that I thought she would. And it actually came full circle when her family, who was not members of the church, called me, and they were like, you cannot marry her. And here's why.
Wow. Interesting.
And so, cause they really liked me, and I still get emails from them or Christmas cards from them once in a while. Wow. So
she is not Mrs. Eborn at the
moment. No, she's not Mrs. Eborn. She never was, never will be.
Nice. So you studied culinary school. Uh-huh. So are you a chef?
I wouldn't say a chef at this point. I'm long since removed from being in the restaurant industry, but I can cook. Okay. So I can.
What's your go-to meal?
Dude, I've got some really good Mexican dishes. So I've got a chicken enchilada recipe that'll knock the socks off just about anybody.
So. Wow. So whenever the chili cook-off comes around or some type of contest, you take home the gold.
Yep, I win. I will say I lost this year here at work. We do one every year at Halloween.
Oh, really?
And I lost this time. So
wow, the king has fallen.
Yeah.
So where did you end up meeting your spouse?
So interesting enough, a family that I met in my very first area of my mission, and I stayed friends with them after they were married. They went through the temple and were sealed. And I just stayed friends with this family, and they moved away from Minnesota, where I served, to Columbus, Ohio. And I stayed the night with them one night as I was traveling cross country from being out here back out to the Washington, D.C. area where I was living. After I left Utah State, I went to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And he kind of joked with me and said, hey, why don't you come and work with me for the summer if you don't know what you're going to do? And I said, well, I'll think about it. And that was really it. He painted houses, and I can't even draw a straight line, let alone paint anything. And he just kind of joked. He's like, oh, it's just manual labor. It's no big deal, you know? But I went back to Washington, D.C., and I really was pretty lost as to what I was going to do. And so I called him up, and I just said, hey, were you serious about that, about coming and working with me? He's like, yeah. He's like, I got a guest room for you. And he's like, and you can come stay with us. So I threw my stuff in my car and drove to Columbus, Ohio. So I started working with him. I got there on a Wednesday, and Sunday at church, I was sitting there, and this cute little bubbly girl comes walking across the chapel after sacrament meeting. And Kim, the wife in this family, she says, Adrian, this is my missionary, Elder Eborn. He's staying with us to work through the summer. And this girl looked at me and she went, hey, and like kind of brushed me off real quick. And that was it. And I was like, all right. But she'd just gone through a pretty rotten divorce and had three small kids. They at the time, they were 3, 5, and 7. And they invited her over for a cookout. This family that I knew that I was living with had two autistic kids. And so Adrienne used to bring her kids over to their house to just have for the social aspect for the kids. It was really good for them. And she visited with John and Kim, and they brought her over, and we had a cookout, and I tried to get to know her. I even got out my guitar and sang, and that's usually like a deal breaker, you know, like that's, and like, she just didn't even talk to me. And when she left, I said to John, I'm like, well, that's obviously not going anywhere. And he's like, oh, I don't know. You'd be surprised. And then a week or two later, she called the house, and I was just like, oh, hey, Kim's not here right now. And she's like, well, I was actually calling for you. And I was like, okay. And she made up some lame excuse. She needed to buy a pair of pants and none of her friends could go shopping with her. So did I want to go into Columbus and go shopping for pants with her? And so I went and we had a great time. She mentioned to me at that time that she wanted to learn to play the guitar, but she's like, I have a guitar, but I don't know how to play. I've always wanted to know how to play. And I said, well, I'll teach you. I'll give you lessons. And she said, okay, I can't start this week. It'll have to be next week. And then she was gone the next weekend. And I found out later that she drove to Frederick, Maryland, where her dad lived, and said, you need to take me to buy a guitar.
Oh my goodness.
And so she got a guitar and I gave her one lesson, which she never practiced. But by then I realized that she didn't really want to learn how to play the guitar. Nice. She's just looking for an excuse to to be around me. But probably within a month or two, we were just kind of always together.
Yeah.
After that. And so we met in July, we got engaged in October, and we got married in February. So actually next weekend is our 12th anniversary.
Wow, so. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And you married into three kids.
I did. Yeah. I married into three kids.
You didn't probably expect that to happen.
No, I didn't expect it. So I'll backtrack a little bit. Between the time that I was in Utah and Virginia, after my mission, I'd broken up with this girl. I was meeting with my bishop from my home ward in Montpelier. And he said to me in an interview, just us chatting in his office one day, he said, have you ever considered that you might marry somebody who has kids? And I said, no, not really. And I said, not that I'm opposed to it. I don't really know anybody in that situation. I'm obviously not like going after that. And he says, I just feel strongly that with the experience you had with, helping take care of my nephews when I lived in Virginia with my sister, the whole cooking school thing and the experience you have as a missionary, he's like, I just feel like everything you've experienced is preparing you to be a father a lot sooner than you think you are.
Oh, wow.
And that was the end of it. And that was kind of what sparked when I moved to Ohio with my friend, John. I told him that story and he goes, oh, I'm getting goosebumps. but that was like the day after I got there. And so I hadn't even met Adrienne yet. Wow. And later he told me, he says, as soon as you told me that story, I knew something was going to end up with this gal.
Wow.
And so, I definitely was not like emotionally, financially prepared to take on, you know, a wife and three kids who were coming out of a rough situation.
Yeah.
I bet. It was not a super pretty divorce. So when we got married, the kids, so we had an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old boy and then a 4-year-old girl. And now they're 20, 18, and 16.
Oh my goodness.
And then we've added another little one. We have a 4.5-year-old little girl. And so, but I've always looked at those kids as my kids.
Yeah.
In fact, I usually don't even specify that they're stepkids until people start trying to do the math. And they go, wait a minute, 20-year-old boy and you're 35. And they're like, you got started early, but.
Interesting. So, were you able to get sealed as you got married, or was it, I know that can kind of be a lot of paperwork and
there was some paperwork and there was some kind of a change that happened. And I still don't know what it was. We had to wait 5 years.
Oh, really?
And so we just had a civil marriage with our bishop and it wasn't even something that like in 5 years we had to submit paperwork. We submitted paperwork right when we wanted to get married initially. And they came back and said, when you've been married for 5 years, you'll receive a letter of an annulment. And that's what happened. We hit our 5-year anniversary and maybe a week or two later, we received a letter from the Office of the First Presidency granting the annulment of her previous sealing. And so on March 27th, so we got married February 5th. And so March 27th, 5 years after we got married, we were sealed in the Columbus, Ohio temple.
Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. I've heard, I've had family members that, have gone through divorce and usually the letter comes back and says, wait a year and then by the 5 years. So was that hard to absorb?
You know what? I don't know that it was really that hard to absorb. I mean, it was longer than we wanted to wait, but It was what it was. And so we got the letter and we were like, okay, we'll wait.
We'll still be together.
Yeah. We'll still be together. And we went to the temple together all the time.
Yeah.
And, we raised the kids in the church and
always something to look forward to in those 5 years.
And so 5 years later, when we when we were able to go to the temple, I mean, we filled the ceiling room with our friends from our ward that, my wife was born and raised in that ward. So these are people she'd known her entire life and that had kind of been with her as she went through a rotten divorce and they'd had a chance to get to know me. And so it was great.
Cool. Who is the most famous Mormon you've ever met?
Ooh, I caddied for L. Tom Perry at a golf course once.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
How's his golf game?
Not good.
I'm sure it's better now that he's passed on.
Probably. It's probably much better now.
Wow. Yeah. So how did that come together?
My young men's president as a youth was the golf pro that ran a golf course in Bear Lake. Hmm. And we always I worked the grounds crew and we always wanted to. Like everybody wanted to do a caddy job because it was easy to drive the golf cart around and they always tipped, you know? And so it was like, yeah. And it was my day to caddy and I saw the name Perry on the tee time. And so I'm getting the cooler ready with the Gatorade and all this stuff. And I hear the voice come into the pro shop. And the moment I heard his voice, I was like, oh no, because it's so distinct. And, you know, I was 16 years old.
Oh, that's cool.
And I was scared to death to say anything. And he was like, do you know who I am? And I was like, yes, sir. And he's like, are you a member of the church? And I said, yes. And he's like, are you a teacher or a priest? I said, I'm a priest. And he's like, good for you. My name's Tom. You can call me Tom. And I was like, okay, because I wasn't going to call him Tom, you know, like, and so it was a cool experience, but like kind of awkward too,
because you don't expect to interface with an apostle on a golf course.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you don't know whether just do your job or ask him questions.
Yeah.
Or, Right. So that's cool. What's the first general conference talk that comes to mind?
The first general conference talk, like the earliest or just,
the first one that comes to your mind, like, if you think general conference, what's the first talk that you think?
So right now, probably the one that's coming to mind is the one we gave a lesson. We had a lesson in our elders quorum yesterday on was Come Follow Me. Awesome. That was just from this last talk.
Nice. And any point that stands out? did your quorum appreciate it?
Well, I didn't teach the lesson. One of my counselors did, and he did a fantastic job. But we were talking about just how really working with our kids, you know, in particular, and how to set an example and open dialogue with them about topics that are sometimes a little bit sensitive and that kids don't always want to talk about, but to have open dialogue with our kids about exposure to pornography and things like that and how that can affect them. And so, and just talking about helping our kids recognize the spirit and how it affects them when it's there and when it's not there. And so anyway,
nice.
While my thoughts are about our conversation, not necessarily directly the talk, but that's what I've been thinking about.
Cool. What's your general conference tradition?
Oh, we get up and make monkey bread.
Monkey bread.
Yeah. We make monkey bread every
is
general conference.
Is this your recipe
it's actually a recipe that like, I think we got it from my mother-in-law.
Oh really? Lots of butter.
Not as much as you'd think. It's got, so we buy like Rhodes bread dough rolls and cut them into fourths, and then you cover them with butterscotch pudding mix. Yes, yes.
We do this.
And then you put it in a bundt pan, and then we make this caramel sauce. You drizzle it over the top. You let it rise overnight, and then you just throw it in the oven in the morning, flip it upside down. It's gooey and delicious.
Oh,
and
man.
Our kids always look forward to that. Yes. So
very nice. So if you were to speak in general conference, what would you talk about?
Oh, my gosh. I'd probably, if I got to choose, I'd probably end up talking about missionary work.
Nice. You have just a passion there.
Yeah, I just love it.
Nice.
I love it.
Nice. And where do you live now?
So we live in Midvale, kind of in the Fort Union area. Well, not kind of, but in the Fort Union.
Okay.
Area, so
you've talked about your kids. You have four kids.
Yeah, four kids.
And 20 to four, right?
20 to four. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's a
big spread.
Nice. We talked about what you did for a living, and you know, I usually ask people what makes them a unique Mormon, but your story about your ceiling stories, that's very unique. But anything else you'd say that makes you a unique Mormon?
Not really. No. I feel like I'm a pretty average Joe kind of person.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Cool. Cool. And what leadership callings have you had, and what is your current calling?
So I have served as a counselor in an elders quorum presidency, an executive secretary. I was a co-ward mission leader for a while.
Wow.
I've been the ward chorister. I've been a Sunday school teacher, a primary teacher. When I moved here, I had been in the ward for 3 or 4 weeks, and they put me in the young men's presidency. And then I was put in as a counselor in the Elders Quorum presidency here. And then now I'm the Elders Quorum president.
Nice. So what led to the co-ward mission leader? How did that work?
I don't even remember. It was in my ward back in Ohio, and I don't even really remember what the circumstance was. We had a really active missionary program in our ward. Our missionaries stayed really busy, and I think it just was, there was just too much to handle. And I ended up handling most of the stuff that was Sundays, like if we did chapel tours, the gospel principles class. Our gospel principles class had 30 to 40 people in it sometimes.
Wow.
And the other guy that was the co-ward mission leader, he handled joint teaching and splits and made sure the missionary calendar was filled up, and we just kind of had separation of duties, and it worked out fine, but I don't really remember why they they did that.
Nice. So tell us, what do you remember about being called as Elders Quorum president? Was it shocking, surprising? What was the story there?
So to be honest, it wasn't very shocking for me, and not because I was like gunning for it. I was serving as a first counselor in the Elders Quorum presidency, and we'd only been in Elders Quorum presidency for about 6 months. And the guy they called us, the Elders Quorum president, was a super nice guy and has a really good heart, but had some health problems and just was having a really hard time being able to fulfill on that. And there were plenty of conversations between the bishop and I, and even the high counselors and I, that kind of led up to it. So when the bishop said, "Hey, I think we're going to make a change. I've made a recommendation to the stake president for you." It didn't surprise me a ton. Mm-hmm. I went in and had a great meeting with the stake president, and he didn't even really ask me. He just kind of assumed that I would do it.
Yeah.
You know, that it was just, these are things that we need to focus on and what we need to do moving forward. Mm-hmm. And we had a really nice open conversation about it. And he asked my wife, "Will you support him in this?" And my wife said yes, and that's great because my wife is in the Relief Society presidency.
Oh, wow.
And so she's busy too, but So
how long has it been then since you got that call?
I got the call in July, so okay. It's 6 months.
Okay, great. And with that transition of getting counselors called and things, did that go pretty smoothly, or how did you approach that and work through that?
So it was interesting for me, for sure. So initially when I was called and the stake president says, "You'll want to get your counselors picked, you know, as soon as possible so we can make all these things happen." And he talked to me on a Sunday afternoon and wanted to make the change the next Sunday. So he wanted me to have counselors called, ready to go for the next Sunday. And initially I started thinking, okay, I want to call this person. And I knew who it was. I knew who these two people were right off the bat, because that's what I had in my head. Like, this guy's a powerhouse, and this guy's a powerhouse. And so I already had my kind of in my head that that's what I wanted to do. And then I went and was really trying to be prayerful about it. And, I just kept coming back to two different people, and neither of which I knew very well at all. In fact, one guy hadn't even been in the ward very long, and he was kind of quiet. But the other guy I knew, but he also was a little bit quiet. And, you know, if somebody would have asked me who I thought leaders in the ward were, those two names probably wouldn't have popped up.
Yeah.
But I kept coming back to them, and I felt really strongly that these guys should be the counselors. And so I submitted those names to the bishop, and he's like, "Wow, I would not have seen that coming." And it's been perfect. They've been fantastic. So, and then I called a secretary, and then we've been busy enough that I had to call a co-secretary or an assistant secretary. And now my secretary's getting married, and he's going to move out of the ward.
Unbelievable.
So it's all worked out really well.
And how would you describe the demographics of your ward? What's it look like?
So my ward is very interesting. We have three streets that are houses, and then two, one is a townhouse complex and one is a large apartment complex. And so in the apartments, there's quite a bit of transiency, a lot of moves in, move ins, move outs. In the townhouses, most of them are owned, and so there's not a lot of move ins, move outs, but it's a smaller family, younger couples. And then in the streets, it's a lot of families that have been there a long time and are very well established. So we have a lot of very young families with small kids and a lot of older couples that have been in the ward for 40 years. Hmm. So we're kind of spread all across the board with demographics. And we're, to be honest, we're a pretty small ward, like in numbers, not just in geography, but in numbers. Like our average sacrament meeting attendance is probably 130. Hmm. It's not, we're not like a 350 people.
Yeah, you're not ginormous, but you're not starving either. Yeah. So that's,
no, and we have a really good mix of people, but
that's good. So out of all that, what do you feel like impacts your calling the most for those demographics?
Probably time, to be honest, where the people that are in the elders quorum are just in that stage of life that everybody's really busy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of teenagers in the ward. There's a lot of primary kids in the ward. And so we end up with people that, husbands and wives that are constantly on the go.
Yeah.
And so
young families, things like that, or elders, I would imagine, that are in school still.
Yep.
Or,
some of them are still in school.
Yeah.
Some of them are just into their careers. Some of them have just made a career change. And so, yeah, it's, there's, I wouldn't say instability, but just a lot of things going on in their lives.
Yeah. Any way that you've combated that, as far as, and maybe that's the wrong word, but, you know, recognize that everybody's short on time, but still inviting them to participate in service?
I think that I think it kind of comes back to my whole approach with the ward is, so I've been in the ward for going on 3 years now. And until I was in the elders quorum presidency, to be honest, I knew very few of the elders in the ward. I was put in the young men's presidency right away. So I knew all the young men and I knew their parents, but I didn't, as a general rule, I didn't know many of the elders in the ward. And so having been in the ward 2 years and all of a sudden I find myself in a calling where I need to know what's best for these people. I realized I don't know any of these guys. Mm. And, our ward didn't have elders quorum activities. In fact, there'd been one elders quorum activity in the 2 years that I'd been in the ward. Mm. And I wasn't able to go.
Yeah.
But, so you just, everybody's busy. And so nobody really knew each other. And so that's kind of been one of my main approaches, just trying to get people to know each other and be friends.
Yeah.
I think you're much more likely to talk to each other and engage conversation and reach out when you need help, when you actually know and like the people that are around you.
Yeah. Any unique approaches to your meeting schedule? I mean, obviously you have a third hour as priesthood and that's when you shine and do your job. But do you meet as a presidency regularly or anything, any other set meetings week to week?
So at first we did quite a bit of meeting, because we needed to make some adjustments to the home teaching routes and the companionships. And, so we did a lot of meeting at first. And then my kind of goal was, I just wanted to get out and meet everybody and let people know who we were and what we were there and what, that we were interested in them and concerned for them. And so we just kind of Tuesday nights, was our night. We'd meet for 10 or 15 minutes at the church to just kind of coordinate and figure out what we were doing that night and who we were going to go see. And then we were out knocking doors.
Wow.
And being in people's homes and getting to just say hello and get to know them for a few minutes. And it worked out really well because I got to play the dumb card. Look, I've been in the ward a couple of years, but I've been in the young men's. I don't know you. So can I have a few minutes of your time? And Rob, my second counselor, I'm new in the ward. I don't know anybody. Can I have a few minutes?
Yeah.
And Nick, who was, my first counselor, he has been in the ward a few years, but he's a busy guy with work. He's an editor for a TV show and so he stays busy. And so he's like, I don't know many people other than the people that live right around him on his street. And then my secretary was a kid who just got back from his mission. Uh-huh. And so kids who are just back from their mission, even though his family had been in the ward forever, they don't usually pay a lot of attention to the adults. So they know all the youth. And so he's like, I don't know that guy. So it was a good opportunity for us to just say, look, we're going to play the dumb card and we don't know you, but we want to. And that's kind of what we went about doing. It's just trying to get to know people.
Nice. Any specific technology or apps or things you use in your leadership that you live and die by?
So we have a Google Doc that we use. Nice. That, so we've put all of our home teaching routes And I spent a bunch of time building out the calculations, and it tracks visits, percentage visited. We have three districts, and each we have a tab for each district. We have a tab that's got our entire lesson schedule for the whole year, families that I want to visit, another tab that has the families we have visited in the last 6 months, one for home teaching interviews that we need to do, PPIs. And so I try to keep it organized. Sometimes it falls apart, but yeah. I'm trying to. So.
Nice. So that's cool. So let's, as I do in these How I Lead interviews, we just go through five leadership principles that you've found success in or kind of use to guide your course. And the first one you mentioned is love.
Correct.
Expand on that.
So it's always easier to do things for people that you love. And so I've tried to cultivate that kind of brotherhood within the quorum, that we love each other. We're here for each other. We all understand that we have struggles, we have problems, and we are not alone in those things. And sometimes I think that's one of the most dangerous things for us as members of the church, is to feel like when we've got a struggle in our home, maybe it's a relationship struggle with your wife, maybe you're struggling with your teenage boy. That happens.
You would
my
know.
Eyes,
right?
My eyes just got big. Yeah. And sometimes we fall into the pit of, man, I don't know why this is happening to me, but the reality is it's happening to everybody. Everybody has these kinds of struggles. And so when we can offer that kind of love and support to each other, we become stronger as a unit.
Yeah. And is there any, like, how would you say a new Elders Quorum president hears that? What can they go and do this Sunday that does, I mean, there are any habits that you've established in your life so that you're making sure that you're that lovable person?
So I try to get to church a little bit early, and I know it's a total bishopric thing to do to go around and shake everybody's hand, but I really do try to say hello to my quorum as they come in and their families. I really try to say hello every single week. And if I can't catch them before sacrament, I catch them in the hallway. I catch them and I try to just, how's it going with everybody? And I'm not always successful, but I try to do that. And I try to make myself available. And if I know that there's something going on or something exciting going on, I'm totally okay just shooting them a text. Hey, it's Toby. What's going on? I heard things are tough right now. What can I do to help? Or, hey, I heard about your promotion at work. I think that's awesome. Congrats. You know, I just try to reach out, let people know that I'm there.
That's cool. And I, you know, that approach seems, I don't know, maybe you would maybe consider that the obvious that, you know, you greet them as they come to church. But I think, you know, a lot of presidents, they just, get there in time with their family, sit down and wait for sacrament to start. But to make a conscious effort of getting there a few minutes early and then shaking some hands and connecting long before the third hour.
Right.
You know, that's great. The next word you put is stewardship.
Yeah. So we, as priesthood holders, we have a stewardship, whether you have a calling in the Elders Quorum presidency or not. And sometimes that's as simple as we're stewards in our family. But I think that sometimes we neglect the responsibility that we've taken on us as priesthood holders to be his representatives, to be the Savior's representatives here on earth, and to make ourselves available to those we have stewardship over. And sometimes that means that your kids are okay asking you for a blessing if they feel like they need it, even if it seems like something trivial. I always appreciate when my kids ask for a blessing. I got a 16-year-old daughter. It's drama.
Yeah.
You know, but when she's discouraged, she always asks for a blessing, and I appreciate that. And I think that if we truly are stewards over those we've been given stewardship over, then it strengthens our priesthood power, and not just with our families, but with the people we home teach, with the people we teach in quorum, just in general, we become a stronger tool in the hands of the Lord. So
awesome. The next one is faith.
So obviously this is a big deal.
Yeah. Faith is a big deal.
Faith is a huge deal. And right now it's a huge deal. There's a tremendous crisis of faith happening right now. Mm-hmm. We have a couple people in our quorum that are really struggling with that. They've run into some things that, you know, they just feel like, well, if the gospel is true and I'm doing everything I'm supposed to, why do these kinds of things happen? This shouldn't happen. And so but then it always kind of comes back to, we go back to, are you doing the things the Lord has asked us to do? And we kind of joke, the primary answer is the read your scriptures, pray, and go to church. But those are foundational faith building activities. And if we stop doing those things and watering that seed and nourishing that seed that we've been given in the gospel, it can wither and die. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a big believer that if we are constantly working on our own faith, then we can be protected. Yeah. And it doesn't mean things won't be hard. It doesn't mean that we're going to have times. It doesn't mean that we won't have times where like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
But we will have the faith to get through it, to see through those clouds and really see what the Lord is trying to do with us.
Yeah. And you mentioned, individuals in your quorum in the midst of the faith crisis, have they felt pretty open with you about that? Like come to you and talk to you about it or?
Some of them have, of them haven't.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
And you're just aware of it?
I'm just aware.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I don't expect that everybody's going to talk to me about everything, and that's totally okay. I just want to know what I can do for them. Mm-hmm. And so, I really believe that if we're conscious of the struggles that the members of our quorum have, we're more equipped to help them.
Yeah.
You know, it's that old saying, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And then there's the one that you don't know what you don't know until you realize you don't know it. Mm-hmm. It could go on forever, but I think awareness is really key in all that.
Yeah. I like that awareness for sure. The fourth word is accountability is a big one for leaders.
It is. It's a big one, and with all of us, we've agreed to do these things. We've taken covenants upon ourselves. Whether they are our baptismal covenants, our temple covenants, our covenants to our spouse, we've taken covenants upon ourselves and we really do need to be accountable to those things. It's really easy to fall off the wagon of doing the things we're supposed to if nobody's holding us accountable, but it's tough to sit there and say, what am I doing wrong here and what should I change? Because it's always easier to not do the right thing, mm-hmm. I think. And we just have to change that mindset that I need to really hold myself accountable to what I've committed to do. And whether it's what I've committed to the Lord or what I've committed to my spouse or to my children, I've made commitments in my life and I need to be accountable to those. And so I try to, as I teach in quorum or as I talk with people to kind of advise them, hey, just take a look at your life. And if you need to make changes, make changes. Accept responsibility for the mistakes we make. We all make them. And the worst thing we can do is try to act like we haven't.
Yeah.
But if we just take responsibility and take steps to change them, even if they're just baby steps, we're at least moving in the right direction instead of backsliding.
And I think that leads into the last word to put down is discipline.
Yeah. It's, I remember being a missionary and you got up at 6:30.
Yeah.
And in my companionships, we got up at 6:30 and we took an hour to shower, get ready, those kinds of things. And then we had an hour of personal study and we had an hour of companionship study and we did it every day. And we actually tracked it. If we didn't do it, then we had to report that we weren't on the plan.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So the goal was always to be on the plan 7 days. But, if we take that into our normal lives now, like how many days are we on the plan? Hmm. Because it's not 7. I can tell you that. For me, I can tell you it's not. I wish it was.
Yeah.
But, if I can get like 5, I'm feeling pretty good because life is busy and I'm exhausted at the end of the day. And my kids are involved in a million different things. And, my 18-year-old plays football and he wrestles and he's in the productions company at the high school. And I got a 4-year-old who plays soccer. And everybody's got something to do. And so coordinating schedules to read scriptures as a family and pray as a family. And we've done really well with family home evening. We've been lucky that we don't do a Monday nights.
Oh boy.
Blame it on me. I'm in trouble. No, but Sunday nights is the night that we know that we're all going to be home. So we do family home evening on Sunday nights and we do a lesson and we try to do an activity and a snack. I got a 4-year-old. We can't miss the snack.
Right.
But those are things that are important. And if we don't do them consistently, then I think there's lasting results because of that.
Yeah.
I remember listening to Elder Bednar talk about family home evening and how when his kids were younger, he felt like it was just a waste of time. Uh-huh. But he says, if you asked my kids what they remember about family home evening now, the one thing they would say is that they had it.
Yeah.
They may not remember any of the lessons, the spirit they felt or didn't feel. They just remember that they had it, that they consistently did it. And sometimes that's important to set that foundation for your kids.
Yeah.
And personally, just setting foundation for myself that I just know that I'm going to do everything I can to say my personal prayers every day and to read the scriptures or listen to, I mean, I drive from Midvale. It's not that far. It's 15, 20 minutes to work every day. Like, how hard would it be to just open up LDS gospel app on my phone and listen to a conference talk? Yeah. It's not that hard. Uh-huh. And so I think sometimes we make excuses for why we can't get things done. I don't have time to do that. Let's be real. How much time do we waste watching TV, watching football, which I'm totally guilty of, but like, we always have time to go to the temple once a month. We always have time to say a prayer. We always have time to read our scriptures. If we don't, we're convincing ourselves that we don't have time.
Yeah.
And so that's where I think the discipline comes in.
Yeah, it definitely goes back to that discipline. And I love that using the analogy of the mission of, you know, sticking to the plan, you know, and it kind of makes me chuckle because, you know, I remember being so stressed about that, you know, jumping through each hoop in the morning and making sure you're on track. And then thinking, I wonder if I tried to do that with a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old. And it's like, yeah, I mean, they just turn life upside down so quickly that, you know, it's hard sometimes that, man, the day gets away from you and you don't know what to do. So that's great. I think those are solid leadership principles and really applicable to leading a quorum and also managing your life as you do that. You mentioned, as you recalled, you sort of put an emphasis on activities and just getting your quorum together in fun settings. How'd you go about that? What are some of the activities you did and what results have you seen?
So probably the activities, I wanted to find something that we could all get together. Like, we're guys, right? We're all guys. We've got things in common, whether we have talked to each other or not. And so we thought about doing a tailgate party for a U of U game. Sorry, BYU fans.
Oh boy.
We thought about doing a U of U game. But every weekend we wanted to do it, there was something on the state calendar. And so we could never find a weekend to do it. And so we finally just picked a weekend and we decided to do a chili cook-off.
Uh-huh. Because you're going to win.
Yeah. And so we talked about it for a month and a half. And I really was concerned that I was going to get there and get everything set up and like 4 families were going to show, like me and my presidency and 2 other families were going to show up. And we had over 100 people that came.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And we had some that were not very active in the church. We had a family that I invited that they're not members of the church at all.
Oh, wow.
But a husband and wife and 5 kids. And we just said, hey, we're doing a chili cook-off. It'll be fun. It's not really about who wins. It's just, let's get together, eat some grub, let our kids run around and act like lunatics in the gymnasium and enjoy each other's company. And we did. We had over 100 people that came and it was a great activity. And so we're going to do that again this next year. We're going to be planning to have a game night where we're going to have different tables set up and different board games that you can play and get a bunch of families together, get together to do chips and salsa and board games and just rotate around and have everybody spend time with each other. And then recently we had a state conference this last week and or 2 weeks ago and they reorganized our state presidency, but we had a general authority that came that talked a lot about the Book of Mormon and how important it was for us to be reading it and how he shared a story of a guy that, that he knew as when he was a state president living in California that just had a really hard time reading. And so he sat down and read the Book of Mormon with him. And I had a really distinct impression about a particular member of the quorum and I wrote it down.
Wow, that's awesome.
And about 5 seconds later, I got a text from the bishop who was just sitting, you know, half a row over from me. And he's like, we could do that with this person. I was like, I just wrote this down.
And, I got him first.
And then we started talking about doing like a Book of Mormon read-a-thon where we created a schedule. And over the course of a week, we're going to get together in the evening these days for 3 hours. And we're going to read, like if you go and look at an audio book, it's about 42 hours to read the Book of Mormon or 32 hours. Sorry. And if we blocked out time and said, okay, if we do this, we can read the entire Book of Mormon as a ward and just invite the youth, invite the parents and invite these people that, and say, if you can't come every night that we're going to do this for a week, then here's the schedule. We want you to be involved, but allow people to sign up and come and be a guest reader. And so you come and read a particular chapter that you really like, and we're going to do that. You know, we're going to get that organized and get that put together here in the next month or two and just find ways to do things together. And I think as a ward, we did a good job this year of kind of coming up with an activities calendar that's a lot much more involved than what it has been in the past to get the ward to come together and do things. So
That's a great idea. That's fun. So, and not that I expect, you know, a few activities to completely fix the world or anything, but have you seen, I mean, what changes have you seen just on a, you know, in quorum meeting on Sunday because of that?
I actually think it's had a huge impact. We have 62 people on our roster, 62 members of the quorum that are on our roster. And now we've lost a handful to young men's and primary callings and things like that. So that they're at church, but they're not there. But, you know, a year ago we were only having, I mean, we'd have 8 to 10 people in quorum. And through some of the efforts we've gone through, the activities we've had, the visits we've made, where we've honestly sat down with somebody who we felt like should be there and just say, why aren't you there? Mm-hmm. We want you to come. We feel like you have a lot to offer and we miss you not being there. And magically, guess what? That guy comes every week.
Yeah.
You know, and other people that I've said, man, I really miss you in quorum. I know you've got a lot to offer. You have a great insight. And I've tried really hard to kind of transform the way we teach in quorum to, instead of just, all right, if everybody's got a lot to read today, if you want to follow along in your manual, to turn it into much more of a conversation.
Yeah.
And I just think there's been so much better value out of that. And I think in quorum yesterday, we had 19 or 20. I mean, it was packed, you know, our little room that we're in,
yeah,
we filled
it
up.
Full, huh?
And I think that's a direct correlation to the members of the quorum actually talking to each other and becoming friends and guys feeling comfortable. Like people that just don't come very often are coming to quorum. Mm-hmm. And I think it has everything to do with these guys reaching out to each other and being each other's friends. And they, all of a sudden there's a trust value that's there, mm-hmm. and they feel like I can relate with this guy. Mm-hmm. He's been where I'm at, or he's in the exact same boat I'm in. And so when we have these conversations, there's a lot of value to it because it kind of reinforces that whole, I'm not alone in this situation. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in this together, and this guy's maybe done some things that I hadn't thought of that can be really helpful. And so I just think there's a lot of support that comes that way.
Nice. And I'm sure that helps leading into home teaching. I'm just curious about, you know, since you've become Elders Quorum president, have you changed that up as far as your approach, or what's your general approach to that?
So it was funny because when I got in, I was like, I'm not going to be the guy that talks about home teaching every single Sunday.
Yeah.
And then every Sunday I find myself saying something about home teaching. But I definitely don't take the approach of, hey, it's the last week of the month.
Yeah.
Everybody get out and do your home teaching. And then I don't say anything about it until the next month, at the last week of the month.
Yeah.
I talk about it consistently, and not because I'm concerned with a number, but because I know that the guys that are out there that need to be home taught need to be home taught. Mm-hmm. And I know their names, and I know generally what their struggle is, or I know that there's something there that they need and that these guys can provide to each other. And so I do talk about it, but it's been interesting because when I first started, I felt like there was a lot of, not necessarily resistance, but there was a big hesitancy for some of these guys to buy in to that concept of, hey, these guys need to hear what I have to say. They need to be visited. Mm-hmm. Because if you see somebody in church, you kind of have this expectation that, oh, he's doing fine. He's at church every week. He's good.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. You know, there's guys that are at church every week that have a really hard time. Mm-hmm. They're struggling. And maybe it's a faith struggle. Maybe they are having a hard time communicating with their spouse. Maybe they're really struggling with a kid. Maybe they're having a trouble with their job. But they're not going to be like, when you bump into them in the hall on Sunday and say, hey, how's it going? They're not going to be like, well, I'm really having a tough time with my wife right now. They're just not going to do that, you know? And so the home teaching becomes a catalyst for these guys opening up to each other. And so I do talk about it a lot, and I have seen a lot of buy-in. And in fact, one of my counselors texted me on Saturday this last weekend. He's like, hey, were we going to meet Sunday afternoon? Because I really need to go see one of my home teaching families. I just want to know what times we're going to do it. And I said, then you go see your home teaching family, because that, to me, that's much more important than us as a quorum presidency going out and making a visit to somebody. Not that it devalues the visit, but, you know, he's been assigned to look after this family. He's been given stewardship there. And while I've been given stewardship over the quorum as a whole, and I've asked these guys to help me with that, his direct stewardship is to that family. And so I'd rather him go see that family. And so that's something I've tried to institute to people, like, hey, that's your responsibility. And I want to hear a return and report. I want to know what's going on. But ultimately, I just want you to be aware. If I ask you, hey, how's so-and-so doing? I want you to be able to answer, like, he's doing great, or he's doing okay, but he could use a little boost in this. Maybe we could do something else. And so it kind of, you know, warmed my heart a little bit to hear from the bishop this last week that my counselor called the bishop with a concern for somebody else in the quorum and just was like, I just don't know what to do to help him. And I was totally happy to hear that, that he's got a concern for somebody that he home teaches and he's trying to find out what to do to help him. And I don't always have those answers, but the bishop's been giving he's a steward over the whole ward. And so, you know, the fact that he's consciously making an effort and reaching out to find out what he can do to help these people, like, that's what I want to see. That's ultimately what I want. I want us as quorum members to love each other enough to worry and to try to find a solution to help each other. Because I think if we can do that, then it strengthens everybody.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I love that, you know, it's not necessarily the number, but when the concerns start to rise to the top and actually, you know, make their way to the bishop or the elders quorum president, I mean, that, then, you know, it's working. Something's right. happening there and people are obviously connecting and,
right.
and it's working. So, well, this has been very insightful and helpful. I mean, your approach and some of these activities and I think it's, you figured it out, man.
I don't know about that. There's still a lot of work to do.
But, right. Yeah, for sure.
But I think we're headed in the right direction.
Yeah, so. I would agree with that as well. So as you look back on, you know, this last 6 months or so and in the future serving as Elders Quorum President, how have you become a better disciple or follower of Jesus Christ?
So I'll be honest. When I used to be the type of person, I was a little bit cynical and I totally recognize that. And my wife even has made the comment. She's like, you know, this has changed you a little bit. I was very much a person like, well, that's not really my problem. Mm-hmm. You know, like everybody makes choices and it puts them in the situations they're in. That's their accountability. And when I hear about unfortunate situations, I'm like, that's a bummer. But you know, everybody's in those situations because they make choices. And I still feel that way. I still feel like people make choices and sometimes they're not good and it puts them in rough spots. But I do feel that probably the biggest thing in me that's changed is just my desire to want people to succeed. And not that I've ever wanted people to fail, because I don't, but I've worried a lot less about it when before this calling. And now I find myself very concerned with whether or not someone's going to pull through a tough situation and just loving these guys. Like, they all have their own quirks and unique personalities and unique situations. And yes, some of those are caused by choices that they make, but you know what? My situation's caused by choices I make. And I would hope that if I'm struggling, that somebody that I go to church with is going to care about me enough to reach out and say, what can I do to help? And the thought that I could potentially be alone in that is a really sad thought for me. And I would never want somebody to be in that situation. And so I've been given the opportunity to help serve these people and help them through what honestly is at times is a really cruddy life. You know, sometimes it's hard and there's a lot of joy and happiness to be had, but there's tough times. And I just want people to know that there's other people there that are concerned for them and pray for them and want to know that they're doing well and be successful. And that's really what I want to see out of these people. So I want them to be happy. I want them to make good choices, and I want them to be successful in what they do.
That concludes my interview with President Toby Eborn. Bless your heart, Toby. You're doing good work out there, and you hopefully will inspire other leaders and maybe intrigued various ideas in their brain as they've listened to this interview, and hopefully you put those to work and send me some feedback. Let me know how it works as what you've learned from Toby and as you find purpose and application in your own core. So I do need your help out there. If you know of a leader that I have just got to interview on the How I Lead segment that maybe has a unique approach, an effective approach of leading in the church, whatever auxiliary or responsibility they find themselves in, and I would love to reach out to them and set up an interview. We can do this anywhere across the world. I mean, I've interviewed bishops in Spain and Relief Society presidents in Australia and, of course, everywhere in the domestic United States as well. So we can make it work. Just send me their information or let me know that I should reach out to them, or you can reach out to them and make the invitation, and let's line it up. As always, all we ask is $1 a month for the content that we produce at Leading LDS, and you can do that by going to leadinglds.org, and there is an obvious donate button there. You can click on and contribute to what we're doing. That's what keeps it going as we produce more and more content. We want to make it available to leaders across the world, so your help will make that possible. And if you haven't subscribed to like the newsletter or even subscribed to this podcast through iTunes or any other podcatching app on your phone, do so, because that way you won't miss out on future episodes and you can listen to them when they become available. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.